So good. So this is our day of mindfulness, and this is called the Dharma Talk and Discussion. So good. I do have something prepared, but because this is a smaller group today, you know, I think it's very important, like at a day of mindfulness like this, that not only do we take the time to nourish ourselves and deepen ourself in a certain way, with the practices of mindfulness and awareness, but also it's an opportunity in this retreating back from our usual activity and pace of life to also spend some time kind of looking more deeply into this practice, our meditative practice, our quote-unquote spiritual practice, Dharma practice, and most importantly, how that is unfolding in our life, and whether there are anything that we might have some confusions about, or areas of our life that still seem not to be unfolding in a smooth and skillful way, or just you may be reading about Buddhism or hearing talks about Buddhism so much as accessible today, and you just maybe want some clarification about. So why don't we begin? Are there any questions? Please don't be shy. This is an opportunity for us to really see if there's anything that's really not clear about anything. I'll give you a moment to reflect. Is there anything that's, you know, that we've talked about today so far that you're not clear about? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about the space between thoughts?
You know, it's much better to experience it than to talk about it. It's a practice that comes from the great perfection tradition and from the meditative tradition. And it's a way of doing a number of things, you know. I mean, it's a meditation process, and I'm just taking one piece, you know, of it. But again, it's sort of most people, let's say, think that their world of thought is a never-ending process, you know. Like, but again, upon investigation, you see that's not true, right? There may be times of greater rapidity or less rapidity. But there is a space, or gap, small, and that's very meaningful, because one often sees one's mind as like a thing, right? Like we say, the thinking mind, as if there really is such a thing as a thinking mind. That's a thing, you know. And it's, but when you look, you see it's not like that, right? There are just thoughts arising and passing, and the interesting thing is there is this space. Now, what is this space? Right? Because most people, when they think about their mind, they think about thoughts. They don't think about what the thoughts are arising within. And in the deeper aspects of wanting to understand your mind, it's important to understand the bigger picture, that which in thoughts are arising, but also just very experientially to begin to get a sense is that there is this open spaciousness in my own mind, and that can be identified, and that even can be cultivated. And that's very much a game changer. Because again, most people are what? They're totally identified with their thoughts, right? And they think that's their mind, without realizing, no, those thoughts are just what are appearing in my mind. So then what is my mind? So this begins to, it's like an opening into something that's quite wondrous. But we have to get our attention off our thoughts. Right? We don't have to kill our thoughts, destroy our thoughts, get rid of it. But we have to begin to see there's more going on here than just thoughts. There is this quality of mind that is spacious and open. And that also that, you know, when you spend lots of time watching the arising and passing of thoughts, you realize that what? It's endless. They just come and go. They just come and go. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, meaningful thoughts, meaningless thoughts. And yet, most people, their whole emotional life and even their conceptual cognitive life is totally involved in these thoughts, right? And as if these thoughts, even in their arising, have any kind of meaning to them. Because as you watch your mind, you'll see what about your thoughts? They arise, they just arise. They don't need any stimulation at all, do they? Right? I mean, you can just sit here in meditation, absolutely nothing going on, and thoughts will continue to arise about all kinds of stuff. Right? And people will attend to that as if that's significant. I mean, if I, sat down on the bus stop out here in Nebraska, you know, and watched the people go by and the cars go by, and everything that went by, you know, had some kind of significant meaning to me. I mean, that's, you know, what would you say about that person? He's crazy, you know, right? He's crazy. They're just, you know, first of all, what's, you know, the up and down of the cars and the different, the buses and the trucks is like, that's just what's happening. You know, it's not a significant thing, is it? And two is, all the significance I give to whatever is passing is just being fabricated by my mind. It's not real, is it? I mean, you know what I mean? It's not real. I mean, all that's real is, you know, there's a car, there's a bus, there's a truck, or, you know. But anything else that arises, including the labeling, but anything else, this is just my own mental fabrication. Is that true? It's not real. So we need to begin to understand things like this, if we really want to be free. In Buddhism, liberation comes from understanding. When we understand how things really are, then we can, you know, relate to things in an intelligent way. But if we don't know, we often make mistakes. And the biggest, again, because so much of the way we are in the world, the way we relate to each other, the way we relate to the world, the way we communicate, is predicated on our thoughts for most people. And we often don't realize how distorted that is, unless we begin to take a look at it. So that's what meditation, you know, one of the things that meditation does for us. It gives us a technology. It gives us a way to begin to look at, you know, what's that which through which we are interpreting the world may not be clear, right? My glasses may be filthy. And so, you know, the blurriness of the world may not be about the world, but may be about what? My glasses. You know, we even say that we talk about what? Some people have on rose-colored glasses. Everybody know that, right? What does that mean? If somebody has rose-colored glasses on, it means what? Right, everything is rosy. Right, it means you're not seeing the world. The glasses and the color of the glasses is distorting the world. But if you were born with rose-colored glasses and you've always worn rose-colored glasses, you don't know it's the glasses, do you? You think that's the way the world is. Until one day somebody points out, you know, says, "Take off your glasses," and you go, "Wow." So that's the way the world is. You know, some people have rose-colored glasses, some people have very dark glasses. Everything is dark. Everything is heavy, right? And they think that's really what the world is. No, that's the glasses we're wearing. So in the Dharma, we want to have clear glasses that don't distort at all. So again, meditation, mindfulness. That's what's helping us do that. Does that answer your question? Good. Other questions about practice, Dharma? I know I'm not sitting with a group of fully enlightened Buddhas, even though we all have the potential. Don't be shy. Yes.
You said something about fully enlightened Buddhas. When you were giving the different reasons why you might come to the practice, I expected that to be the last thing.
The what?
I thought that would be the last thing on your list, was that you may want to become a fully enlightened Buddha, but you didn't actually say that.
Thank you for saying it for me.
It seemed like you stopped much short of that. So what I always wonder about practice is, what is the value and possibility? Because I do believe it's possible to become a whole, like Buddha for any of us. Mm-hmm. But in reality, of course, most of us deal with the reality of our day-to-day lives and obligations and situations. And so there's always that question of, I mean, obviously the practice is very helpful in any kind of life you live. Mm-hmm. But if you really think that ultimately full enlightenment is the ultimate end of the practice, and then I say to myself, well, I'm not giving up my life as it is right now. Mm-hmm. So am I kidding myself? How far can you go in my current circumstances? The only thing to do, be a monk and go to live in a monastery. I know I'll be enlightened within seven lifetimes of hearing the Dharma, so maybe this is the sixth, maybe this is the seventh.
Maybe that's not true.
Maybe it's not true, maybe it's the first. So
let me respond. Yeah, so that's good. So what is your name again?
Paul.
So Paul's question, I think they're taping this, so that's why I'm repeating the question. Okay. So Paul's question, he challenged me first. He said, hey, when you were talking about the benefits or the purpose of meditation or practice, you didn't mention becoming a Buddha, becoming full enlightenment. Hey, what's going on? And then Paul went on to say, well, what about that? Is that really something that's realizable for a layperson, living a layperson's life, right? Or is that something, that's really beyond the layperson's ability, et cetera, et cetera? So is that something people would like to talk about a few minutes? Yeah, so what Paul's referring to really goes back to the Buddha. And remember, the Buddha was not a monk. The Buddha was a layman who had a family, who led a totally lay life until he had what might be called an existential crisis, right? I mean, he encountered sickness, old age, and death in a real, real, very visceral way. And rather than, like most of us, kind of, just denying or covering over, he went, what? Wow. My beautiful healthy body, my youth, my beautiful wife, my life of privilege and ease, all the beautiful things I have, all of it is subject to decay. Right? None of it is permanent. As well as this body, this everything, I have to die. I got to leave it all. So, to me, I think, what I would say is he became depressed. it was like he became depressed. Right? And all of a sudden, if you read the accounts in this kind of more modern way of looking at it, all of a sudden, nothing had gave him any pleasure anymore. Right? I mean, like he looked at his life and he looked at all the things in the past were all sources of pleasure to him, and they were just kind of flat. Right? And so he kind of went through a crisis, and the way he resolved his crisis, which was, we might say, in his time, something that was accessible. In other words, there were these kind of yogi hermits kind of running around in the woods and the jungles, kind of wandering around, so that kind of renunciate path, right, we might say was it was in his awareness that this was, and that's what he did. You know, he says, you know, I got to get to the bottom of this. So for him, it was leaving his life as he knew it, kind of renouncing all that off and going out into the world. We know he spent 6 or 7 years basically, you know, visiting all the, you know, the big name teachers, we might say, of his time, and practicing with them, but not feeling that that he was really getting the realization he wanted. And eventually he just meditated on his own, right? And it was only out of his own process of introspective meditation that he came to what is called the Great Enlightenment, right? I mean, it was at that moment that he became a Buddha, so to speak. Now, there's lots of teachings in Buddhism that says, no, he had been practicing for lifetimes. You know, he had been working his program of selfless service and compassion, and, you know, and that basically he already much had been transformed and healed within him, and so therefore he was now ready, right, for this great an experience. I mean, again, please understand, if you saw Siddhartha the day before his great enlightenment and you saw him the day after his great enlightenment, he looked the same, right? I mean, we kind of have this kind of distorted magical thinking around this, right? This is, by the way, this is not the Buddha. This is a representation of the Buddha. Is that clear? We don't know if he looked like this. We know he sat in the lotus posture, right? We know he meditated. We know he came to a great realization that produced a great, that everybody who met him kind of felt this kind of aura of, you know, peace, wisdom, you know, just love, you know, that kind of emanated from him. But he still looked like Siddhartha, even though he was now called the Buddha, which just means an enlightened one, the enlightened one, an enlightened one, okay? Is that clear? And so what the Buddha taught right from the beginning, from his great enlightenment, was that this experience he had of seeing through all the delusions of his mind, all the fabrications of his mind, this whole universe that had been created by thought, right? Totally, he broke out of. And he broke into the trueness of the way things really are, okay? And in that moment of enlightenment, you know, it's sort of like the lights went on. Is that clear? I mean, it's not a supernatural experience. Right? It's a psychological experience. It's an experience that goes on within the mind. It's a transformation of the mind, of what it sees and how it perceives itself. Right? All of a sudden, he perceived, really beyond perception, that he was not this. And he was not this. Right? That in truth, his mind, his Buddha mind, his awakened mind, had no form, had no definition. Right? It was spacious and open, and more than that, had this incredible knowing, had this incredible luminosity, had this incredible wisdom that was, you might say, indigenous to it, right? It's not like you didn't have to, you know, the Buddha, and everybody, whether you're a Buddhist or not, unless you're an anti-Buddhist, I guess, would say, oh, you know, a lot of wisdom there, right? Right? You know, you read the Buddha Sutras, you read it, and you say, wow, a lot of wisdom, a lot of intelligence, right? He didn't go to college, right? He didn't go to college. He didn't read any books. Where did it come from? It came from his own mind. That's important to understand. He said at that time and forever afterwards that Buddha mind is the true mind of everyone. Right? It wasn't just like his, or it didn't belong to anybody else. It was the true mind of everyone, okay? rich and poor, high caste, low caste, male, female, right? Neurotic, non-neurotic. People who had good childhoods, people who had terrible childhoods. People who had loving mothers, people who had unloving mothers. Is that clear? He said, it doesn't matter. Everyone has that same mind. And basically he said, the purpose of life is what? To uncover that. Now, the full uncovering of that Buddha mind and the capacity in life to live in total congruence with it, we would call what? A Buddha. Right? And along the way to Buddhahood, there's all kinds of levels of practice and teachers and masters and bodhisattvas and, you know, all kinds of different stages of development, but it's on that path. What's your name?
Paul.
Is that clear, Paul? So that is the, we might say, so is there ultimately a goal in practicing the Buddhist path? Right, it's to become a Buddha, to enlighten oneself, and to constantly have no other purpose in mind than benefiting and helping and bringing, goodness to the world and everyone in it. So that's, you know, so that's the path. So then there's Paul, right up there in New Jersey. And he goes, I've been practicing Vipassana, I've been, kind of benefited my life, right? Kind of see changes. Maybe I'm a better person than I used to be, right? And he says, that's good, but what about this becoming a Buddha stuff? Is that, the way I would see it, Paul, is, do you know who Yo-Yo Ma is, let's say? What would you say about him?
Great cellist, maybe one of the best.
Right, so he's an extraordinary being, but mostly he's known because he's, I don't know if he's the greatest, but so we might say in the world of cellists, he's a Buddha. Okay, we'd say he's fully realized cellohood. Okay, right? So he's fully realized cellohood. All right, so now we have what it looks like. Okay, right. Now there's Paul. He's taking up the cello. He goes to a concert, he hears Yo-Yo Ma, he goes, wow, right? I want to play like that. Is that clear, right? Now this is Paul's problem, you see, Paul. You know, so you got the cello, you bought the cello, you got the string, so you're here, you want to be like Yo-Yo Ma. Nah, Paul. See, here's your dilemma, you see? If you really want to be like him, well, you got to maybe either meet him or read about him and learn what? How did he get there? Right? Did he practice 20 minutes a day? You know what I mean? Did he practice 30 minutes a day? Did he practice 60 minutes a day? Did he practice 3 hours a day, 6 hours? You know what I mean? And then it's clear. Now again, whether you become Yo-Yo Ma in this lifetime, you know, we'll see. But you get a sense of, this is how you become good at this. So the question is not about whether you can become good at it, Paul. It's the question is, how much time and energy and effort and aspiration and intention do you want to devote to it? I mean, that's what Buddhism says. There's no barriers other than what we set. Now again, in Buddhism, is the path open to, do you have to be a monk? No. Right? That's not the teaching of Buddhism. You know, there are various lifestyles that one can choose in terms of how to practice the Buddha way. Right? But since awakening is a practice of the mind, the mind is always here. And whether you're a layman and leading a layman's life or a laywoman's life, or if you're a monk, and you know what I mean, it's still your mind. So the question is, you know, how much energy in your life are you devoting to the cultivation of mindfulness, insight, concentration? How much, you know, how deeply you're practicing the teachers of selfless service and the paramitas, you know, can you practice them in your daily life? Of course. Are you familiar with the Vimalakirti Sutra? The Vimalakirti Sutra. Vimalakirti Sutra. Well, go get yourself a copy. Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti. And there are a couple of, there are two major translations. I think the one by, Burton Watson. Bob Thurman also translated it. But this other translation, I think, just reads a little easier. The Vimalakirti Sutra. Sutras are traditionally the teachings that are purported to be the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha is always like the central hero of the sutras. The Vimalakirti Sutra is a very interesting sutra, because Vimalakirti, which the sutra is based on, was a layman in the Buddha's time. And yet he's the hero. It's also kind of an interesting story. So it is a very much loved and respected sutra, because when you read it, you'll see Vimalakirti was fully enlightened. And yet he lived the life of a layman. Family, work, business, on the PTA, you know, things like that. He was, right? He was, you'll see it. It's quite a wonderful sutra, and always in the Mahayana countries, very loved by lay people, obviously, for obvious reasons. So you'll see the path is open to you, Paul. Other questions about practice? Yes, Sergio.
You talk about the Buddha having multiple lives and realizing the Buddha nature.
Well, let me just say that again. Traditionally in Buddhism, it is explained that way. Because you have to remember, traditionally in Buddhism, Asian Buddhism, a belief in rebirth was common. I mean, you know, the Buddha Shakyamuni, again, which is wasn't his name, that's only after he became, that was what he was called, in his culture, a Vedic culture, everybody believed in, you know, many lives and rebirth. I mean, reincarnation, rebirth, there's differences, but so just understand that that was just, you know, that's where everybody saw it. The same way if you probably grew up in a Judeo-Christian, I don't know, culture where everybody believes what happens when you die. You go to heaven. I mean, it's, you know, nobody even might question it, right? So it's, please understand, it's like that.
What is the Buddha's take on reincarnation?
You want me to answer that one? No. I don't know if I want to get into that today. Again, just to, I mean, I guess, you know, this is just my opinion. Again, it just, you know, in the Buddha's time, and traditionally Buddhism developed in Asian culture where that was, so as it went from culture to culture, that was not a problem for people. Okay? People probably already believed it, you know, that there was this continuation of life. Right? And exactly how that happened, there could be different views on that, but there was belief. So that was, you know, not a question for people, the way it might be a question for Sergio, like, what are they talking about? But you see, that wasn't even a question for them, okay? The interesting thing is, as far as we know, the Buddha didn't get into it. So when he was, you know, questioned about it, like somebody like Sergio would come to him and kind of ask him a question, he didn't really get into it with them. He would say things like, what would he say? He'd say things like, Sergio, if you're really interested in kind of who you were, what you were up to in your past lives, right? Look at your life condition in this life. Because the causes you made in your past life, in this life, are now effects. So if you want to get a sense of where you might have been in the past, look at the way this life has unfolded to you, both positively and negatively. You know, kind of that's, I mean, that's what he would say. And for people who wanted to say, you know, because again, you know, in the Buddha's time, you know, lots of astrology and fortune telling and, you know, all that kind of shamanic stuff was also very much in the culture. And when so people asked him about future, he would say, well, again, you know, what kind of causes are you making in this life through the actions of your body, speech, and mind? Because what you're doing is making the causes for your future. If you want to see how your future is, look at what you're doing right now. Because that's what's going to be continuing.
That's the samsara concept that he talked about?
The samsara concept that he talked about. Well, you're going big today. Right, so again, in a certain way, yes. So there is this kind of wheel, samsaric wheel of birth and death, cause and effect, positive and negative, virtue and non-virtue, that all human beings, let's say, we'll leave out the other realms for a moment, and we're not going to get into that, you know, that people are just cycling through. Right? Because of causes and conditions. Okay? And so to understand, I mean, this is why cause and effect and impermanence are so, what I call the preliminary, are so important, is because they explain that. Right? You know, why am I the way I am? Because of causes and conditions from my past. You know, why, when I sit here in meditation, do these thoughts arise just on their own? Well, because the seeds of them are in our past. We've thought these things, we've seen these things, we've, you know, and they're just, the seeds are there and they're just arising, right? It's not like, you know, it's not like some kind of science fiction, you know, where people are, you know, sending these thoughts into you, which many people kind of, you know, think, you know, like, you know, where do these things come from? Well, they come from your own mind, and they're your own, right? They're in your own alaya vijnana, your own storehouse consciousness they're coming from, right? And so, you know, that's always unfolding. Now, they unfold, right? Whether what is unfolding right now in your life, in your mind, whatever, is the causes of that are in this lifetime, your family of origin, what happens to you, what you think, the work you did, you know, you know, all that, culture, you know, that's all conditioned me. You know, that certainly gives you a lot to work with, right? And if you want to add 10 or 20,000 lifetimes, you know, that just kind of, you know, makes it richer, right? Oh, you know, maybe, you know, I've been bringing some of this stuff with me longer than this lifetime. I mean, to me, I find the idea of rebirth kind of rational. It explains a lot, you know, because there are things that we experience in this life or feel in this life or directions which we cannot find the seeds of in our family of origin, right? Or in our, you know, third grade teacher, it was like, you know what I'm saying? Or even in our culture. So you know, so kind of seeing, yeah, maybe some things, you know, came with me, to me explains a lot. But I think even if you don't buy into that, you know, I think for most of us it's enough to work on just, in, you know, in our past from this lifetime. Right. But so the causes and conditions of our past arise, but where do they arise? They always arise in the present. Your thoughts always arise in the present. You always talk in the present. And you always act in the present. Is that clear? You know, life isn't going on anywhere else. Just nod your head if you agree with me. I think a couple of weeks ago I was joking with our Sangha here that I'd been up giving a retreat in Southern Dharma, retreat center up in North Carolina. And most of the time, I've been going up there years, really by this time when I do the 7-day retreat, most of the people who come are either our own members or people from around North Carolina or whatever who's just been going to my retreats for years. So we're sort of all on the same page. But I did an extra retreat this year, and most of the people were not members. And I realized, kind of by the second day, I was saying something about the present moment, you know, kind of the usual, you know, past is gone, future hasn't happened. And I can tell that people were not agreeing with me. You know, and some of the questions people were asking me, I mean, people with, you know, thought their thoughts about the past were real, or their past was real. Anyhow, it's so I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Okay? So this right now, this is where our life is. We have it, we might call it the present moment, but as soon as I call it the present moment, it's already gone, right? So whatever this is our present. Is that clear? Anything that has preceded this, even the words I said a minute ago, have disappeared. Is that clear? I mean, I've been talking, rambling on here for nearly an hour, and everything I have said is disappeared. Is that clear? Right? And you may have a memory of it, I may have a memory of it, there's a camera, so you know, we may have an image of it, but it's past, isn't it? Now again, if I watched, I wouldn't want to watch, but if you want to watch one of those, those Dharma Talk videos, you would be watching it when? In the present moment, even though we might say, oh, that's a talk he gave 2 years ago. But your experience of it would always be in the present. You never experience things in the past. Is that clear? Even if, you know, because I think I got into somebody who was talking about their trauma and their memories. It's like, yeah, I understand all that, but that's all past. I mean, that happened to you when you were 5 years old. You're not 5 years old now. I mean, they had to agree with me, they're not 5 years old. Right, and so whatever re-experiencing of that kind of memories or feelings or body that, you know, from the past, you're experiencing it when? In the present. Right? Nowhere else do we experience life but in the present. That's why it's so important to learn to be present. Right? Because one, this is where life's going on, and if you can do any healing and transformation, it can only happen now. Right? I mean, it's only in movies and fiction, right, that we go back in time and we kind of redo things, you know, right? I mean, those are movies. Is that clear? That's not real. Again, I just want to put that out there. Make sure we're all on the same page, okay? If we're going to heal it, transform the wounds from the past, we do it in the present. Right? Anybody disagree with me? Please say so. Okay. On the other side, any thought, any visualization, any imaginary construction that we postulate about what hasn't happened yet, and we think will happen, that is, again, a total fabrication of our minds. It is not real. Is that clear? I mean, I say this because we so glibly, and especially people who have been around Dharma, talk about, oh yeah, there's no past, there's no future, there's only the present, right? And then they continue on with their ruminations about their past and fantasizing about their future, and they have anxieties. It's like, hold on, I thought you said it's not real. Then if it's not real, what are you so upset about? You know what I mean? I mean, I don't quite get it. Or maybe their thing is when people think they get something intellectually, they don't really get it. Okay? Because when you get it, then you're clear. When you get the past is the past, it's over, right? And if anything is left over, it's arising in the present, and I can deal with it. You know, there are lots of nice, good ways, meaningful ways to heal and transform what is arising in the present. At the same time, all my thoughts, all my expectations, all my worries, all my fantasies of the future have not come. They're not real. Does anybody disagree with me? It's a waste of time. I mean, again, doesn't mean you don't plan for your retirement, but that's like, you know, that's not like every day. Right? Is it? It's not like you don't, you know, think about what you got to do today and you have your little day planner, right? I mean, that takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I mean, it's not something to be thinking about and worrying about, is it? I mean, when it happens, you'll deal with it, right? And the more you have the capacity of living in the present, being very alive and mindful and alert and stable and grounded in the present, when that imagined future comes into reality, it'll be what? It'll be your present moment. Then you deal with it. All the energy you put into anticipating your expectations, you know, most of it is useless, meaningless, and also painful for many. Again, it doesn't mean that in a very conscious way you may want to do a little role rehearsal. You know, there are psychological techniques that are beneficial. I'm not saying that very directive, clear way of thinking in a positive way, you know, may not be helpful. But even that is just imaginary, right? Rehearsal is not the real big show, is it? We even say it's a rehearsal. So, understanding cause and effect, understanding that there's a lot coming, could be coming into this moment from our past that's alive now, should just allow you to understand it's not under my control, right? There may be things I know, there may be things I don't know that are causing things to unfold the way they are, right? But I understand everything that's arising is arising because of past causes and conditions. Okay? And if I want my future not to be like that, I better get on the stick and start making some different kind of causes in my life to create different effects. And that's why Buddhism is so much a practice of how we learn how, in a wise, intelligent, compassionate way, make sure that you know, the activities of our mind, the activities of our speech, and the activities of our body are all congruent with health, well-being. Right? Good causes in the actions of our body, speech, and mind. I mean, is that?
Yes.
And again, we can have a discussion about rebirth and reincarnation next lifetime.
Right.
That's a date. Other questions? Yes. Different wounds?
Wounds.
So things have happened to you. Okay. It's important that, you know, again, language, how we describe experience is very important. And I understand, I mean, I worked in the mental health field, that trauma is a word that is used these days to describe kind of extraordinary occurrences in life, right? But please understand, they were just an experience, right? So you're talking about experiences that you remember. Okay.
And then in the present day, when you're, say,
that say you really come up and talk about transforming and healing.
Right.
But just being present is something that you consider very traumatic.
Mm-hmm. What is your name again?
Karen.
Karen. So that's a big one. I mean, again, I'll say something about it, but that's like a whole Dharma talk or a whole retreat or, okay? All right. So, as Karen said, we sit, things come up. We go through life, and things come up. And many of the things, most of the things, the way we react or respond is because of past causes and conditions. Right? And a lot of our past causes and conditions were good, and a lot of them were very painful, traumatic, suffering, okay? And we won't go into it, but those things just come up by themselves. You don't consciously bring them up, do you? Right? They may be feelings, emotions, memories of, all kinds of things, mind states that just kind of grab you, okay? All right. And so the first thing you said is just mindfulness enough? And I would say, could be, but probably not. Okay? If you were a highly developed on the way to Buddhahood, with a mind that is vast and open, right? Within the context of that vast, open mind, that arisal of some kind of afflictive emotion or memory could just arise and pass through without any effect. And just that open awareness could be enough. Okay, it's like you're creating lots of space around it. It's sort of like in Buddhism we say, don't grab the snake. Right? If you just let the snake be there, right? Give it space. Don't startle it. Don't grab it. If it grabs it, what's going to happen, Karen? It's going to bite you. Right? So you give it space. You step back. Maybe it'll just unfold itself and go away. It probably will. So Karen says, but I've been doing that for years, and I'm sick of having this damn snake in the house. All right. I can understand that, right? So Karen says, I want to do something with this snake. I'm sick of living with a rattlesnake. I mean, I've learned to give it space. I've learned to, I don't grab it anymore. But it's okay. Is that clear? All right. So that's why I say yes, but no. Okay. So you're saying yeah. Okay. So now the question is, how do you deal skillfully with a snake? Which is different, isn't it? Can you see? It's a different question. You're saying, well, if I'm going to handle a snake, what's the best way to handle a snake? We know just letting it be is the easiest way. But then but you say, no, I want to handle it. So again, there are lots of ways. I mean, we have a whole, not even talking about Buddhism, but in terms of Western psychology, there's certainly lots of therapeutic ways that have been developed that are very helpful to healing and transforming that part of you. We call that inner child work, right? We call that trauma walk. I mean, it's talking about the same thing, right? There are all kinds of ways of working with that part of us that is, again, I often say to people who are doing inner child work, and I certainly have great respect for it and used to recommend it and teach it, but we all understand there's no little inner child, there's no little seven-year-old running around inside you. I mean, is that clear? It's a helpful concept. It's a helpful image. But you don't have an inner child inside you. Has anybody ever, Can anybody show me their inner child? People say, well, I can see my little wounded seven-year-old. I can understand you can see it, but it's an imaginary scene, isn't it? Is that clear? There's no inherent existence, but we're talking about what in Buddhism is called a mental formation. That's something just has formed within my mind. It's called a formation. It's a formation that involves memories, feelings, thoughts that have all kind of coalesced into kind of something, right? And when it gets touched, it blossoms, right? So that's the way kind of Buddhism would traditionally call what we call, you know, traumatic experience, wounded inner child. You know, it's these, right, these kind of formations that have developed in the mind, and they're like knots. Another way Buddhist psychology might look at it, they'll call it fixations. You know, I got fixed on this, right? My mind and emotions got fixed. I can't, even though it might have happened 50 years ago, it's kind of that the knot is still there, right? So we got to untie that knot. I mean, I would certainly say mindfulness is a great ground for that. It gives you that space. It gives you that capacity to be objective. I'm aware that there's fear in me. I'm aware that there's anger, rage in me. I'm aware that there's sadness, despair. You know, it gives you that space to be aware of what's arising, to name it, and not to be overwhelmed by it, to hold it. Right? I'm not going to go into it, but then there are various kinds of interventions or things that one can do with that proceed, you know, that will more quickly bring about healing. You know, the mind, the mind is no different than the body, right? The body can be healed, right? You know, I mean, we have a deep wound, right? And if that deep wound is treated and taken care of, it will what? I mean, it's magical, isn't it? Right? People get cut up, people get, you know, shot, people get in accidents, bones get broken, skin gets ripped open, organs get all twisted about. And if, you know, they're handled skillfully, they heal, right? Oh, even the scar fell off. Well, the mind is the same way. The mind can heal because the mind is not a fixed thing. It has this very resilient capacity, right? So the mind can heal. It's just that people don't know that. So they, you know, it's like having a wound that we never healed. It's like, oh, I didn't realize. You could put something on that and it would heal it. I just thought it was something I had to live with. Right? I mean, have you ever been to the third world? I mean, people were walking around the third world with all kinds of things, you know, that we know, right? If you've ever been to the third world and you go into a lot of these very poor areas, you know, if you have like triple antibiotic cream, you're like a great physician. You know, it's like, oh, you just put a little of this on this. Oh, you put these little drops in, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, you know, this thing that the people are living with, oh, it can be healed, right? You know, all kinds of, there are lots of physical things like that, that people just don't know or have access, right, to the means of healing. In the same way, many people don't have access or means to, you know, how you go about healing these places within you that have been wounded. I mean, even the word wounded, you know, can you see how crazy it is? I mean, if people say, by the way, is it getting a little warm in here? Or is it just be a little AC? I mean, is that clear? You know, it's like when I'm carrying around wounds from the past, right? See, if you were still carrying around physical wounds and weren't healing them, that would be obvious that something's really wrong, isn't there? It's like, how come you haven't gone to the doctors? Or how come you haven't, you know, wounds can be taken care of. But the problem with so many people in our culture, their emotional wounds are never addressed. Their emotional wounds are covered over, denied, repressed, you know what I mean? All the stuff that gives therapists a good living. Because we have not understood, right, how to take care of, when they happen, those wounds. Right? I mean, we even call it post-traumatic stress disorder, don't we? Which acknowledges what? What? The effects are coming afterwards. And oftentimes we know that if there's an immediate intervention with someone who's gone through a difficult situation, that they may not, good chance they will not have PTSD. Right? There's a whole field of crisis intervention, you know, get right in there. Get right in there and you work with people who have been traumatized in a situation, they won't get, hopefully they won't get PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Right? Any other questions? Do you have any questions about practice, your life? Don't be shy. There's no extra charge. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're saying, because I've been responding to different questions, there's been a piece of this and a piece of that.
Yeah, okay. And life is sometimes like that, a piece of this, mm-hmm. a piece of that. And sometimes I question how to put it all together.
Yeah.
How to stay in the moment and not get caught up on one, perhaps.
Yeah. Did everybody, let me just repeat it. This is being recorded, right? That's why you're up there, Brian? Okay. So the question is, Fred, you've been responding to this question and that question, and sometimes you feel in your own practice that you're responding to this situation or that situation, but what? Is there something that holds it all together? Is it kind of simpler than having, lots of, sort of like, a bag of 50 different medicines, Is there any like one medicine for all kind of thing? I think that's important. I think many people, their approach to Dharma, like their approach to life or their own spiritual life, is collecting teachings and collecting techniques. Many people, their spiritual life is a collection of techniques, right? Oh, when this arises, what am I gonna do? I was just talking to somebody the other day, they were going, yeah, when that happens, I ground myself. And when that happens, I stabilize myself. And when that happens, I remind myself of this. And when that happens, whew, that was complicated. A lot to keep together. So it's people, many people, they practice their spiritual path as if it's just a series of techniques. Got to come back to my breath. Many people say that. Got to get back to my breath. Whew. Like it's a technique. Got to ground myself in my body. Whew. Like it's a technique. Rather than something that one is cultivating all the time, right? Creating a ground, not just a ground when I'm flying away. It's like the ground that I'm always walking on, right? So, you know, again, you know, there are many, many teachings in Buddhism, but, you know, like right now, many of us in our community are involved in the mind trainings, the Lojong practices, right? What are called the mind trainings. They actually come from India. They went to Tibet where they were preserved. They were brought to Tibet by a great Indian teaching teacher called Atisha. Came from one of the great Buddhist universities of northern India. He says, first begin with the preliminaries. That's the first slogan. They're 57, right? So, you know, to me, you know, before you jump into all your meditative practice, this is before you even begin meditation, you do the preliminaries. What are the preliminaries? Impermanence. Everybody here will say what? Oh, I know about impermanence, right? Anybody not know about impermanence? If you know about impermanence, raise your hand. Okay. If you believe things change, raise your hands. Or if you believe things don't change, don't raise your hand. Glad to see somebody's paying. Okay. So we all say that. But if we really understood deeply what impermanence means, what does impermanence mean? There's nothing stable anywhere. Everything is changing. Everything is just comes into being, stays, and then decays and disappears. Everything. Right? Every moment, like every moment we've had so far today, where is it? Gone. Right? Everything you felt today, every thought you've had, where are they? Gone. Right? Moment to moment, you watch your mind, you see. Impermanent. Thoughts just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. Feelings coming and going. Right? Bodies. Right? Come and going. You don't look the way you did when you were born, do you? I mean, Desiree, how old are you? 10. So do you look the same way you did when you were 5? No. Might you look different when you're 20? Yeah, 30, 40. Right? So change, right? You're 10 years old. Is your body changing? Kids at school, do they sort of beginning, are their bodies changing? Yeah, so change, right? Why do things change? Because everything's impermanent. The world's impermanent. We call that, you know, like we have things like we call the study of history, right? What is the study of history? Change. Things change, right? This one died, this king died, came into rule, died, right? This country dominated, didn't dominate, that country dominated, you know, right? Right? This war was fought, then it ended, then they went and fought another war, right? What does that say? Impermanent, impermanent, permanent. You know? All our many of our grandparents, great aunts and uncles, where are they? Where are they? Dead. They're gone. Impermanent. So to really get impermanence is no longer in the face of this world of change and instability to not be anxious, to not be scared, to not be angry, right? To not be despairing. Why? Because one understands that's just the nature of things. Right? It's real. I get it. I don't just get it here. That's big picture. When you get it, you're at ease with the groundlessness of things. Right? Cause and effect, right? That's another big picture Buddhist thing, right? Karma, everybody heard of karma, cause and effect. Everybody understand what it means? Yeah, we say it. Oh yeah, Sergio goes, yeah, I get it. If you got it, Sergio, you would never, ever again be angry at anything. Because you would understand, why did this unfold the way it is? Because of causes and conditions. Why is she the way she is, he the way he is, not the way they are? Because of causes and conditions. You'd have, you know, it's all cause and effect. You know, why do we have the world the way we do? Why is Donald Trump the way he is? Causes and conditions. I mean, he can't be anything than he is, can he? Right? He has no control over it. I mean, unless he got some self-awareness, but that doesn't seem to be in the cards. Right? So there's an acceptance that comes from understanding cause and effect, that's all that's going on here, right? That in this impermanent world of change, it is proceeding according to a law. What is that law, cause and effect? It's not just random. Donald Trump didn't just come out of nowhere, right? He was produced by causes and conditions. We understand that. So we can deal with Donald Trump skillfully, intelligently, wisely. But we don't get all that anger. We don't get, I can't believe he said what he said. Right? I mean, talk about stupid comment. He just said it. So we can't believe it. Why can't we believe it? Because in our world, what? People don't say things like that. But if you have understanding, according to what you understand, Donald Trump speaks in Donald Trump's world. We don't control his world. Right? Is that clear? So all that kind of, you know, why do people die? Cause and effect. Why? You know, we go, somebody dies and you go, I can't believe it. Right? People talk like that, right? Did you hear what happened? I can't believe it. People die in permanence, and they die because of causes and conditions. Something must have happened, right? It doesn't mean we may not be sad if we love them, but I mean, there's this understanding. We're not angry. Why, you know, we shouldn't be this way, right? People go, so angry. Those people. The world should not be this way, right? People go like that, don't they? Global warming. Shouldn't be this way. How could it not be that way? It is the way it is. Why? Because of who's in this world. It's Paul? Is it a world full of enlightened Buddhas? You don't think so. It's a world full of what? Deluded, self-centered, foolish, greedy, short-sighted human beings, right? Doesn't mean they're not, you know, they also have kindness, they also, you know. But, you know, how could they do otherwise? Right? How could they do otherwise? I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh made a very interesting statement, I guess a year or two ago, talking about global warming. It wasn't a very optimistic, but he said something to the effect, this planet is suffering. But he said, you know, most human beings, they can't even deal with their own suffering. You know, how are they ever going to deal with the suffering of the planet? You know what I mean? It was a very wise statement. It's like, you know, most people can't even acknowledge their own suffering and take care of their own suffering. You know, it's a big leap for them to really kind of see the suffering of the whole planet or the suffering of other people on our planet and be willing to acknowledge it, want to do something about it. So cause and effect, big picture. So those are kind of this view, you know, in Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, we talk a lot about right view, you know, then they also talk about the viewless view, but that's something else. Having the right view, really seeing things as they really are. I mean, that cuts out a lot of the nonsense, right? Because most of our nonsense it's petty. You know, we get caught up in this thing and why didn't she do this, or I can't believe he said that, or this didn't work out the way I wanted it to, and right? It's also petty, isn't it? We reduce our life to a series of small encounters that we give big meaning to. to practice a spiritual path is to see the big picture. Is that clear? It's big picture stuff. It's like, right? It gives you the big picture that you can fit everything into. So everything makes sense. A spiritual practice, a spiritual tradition, a spiritual teaching should help us go, oh, now I understand. You know, it promotes understanding. It shouldn't promote confusion. It should bring clarity. I mean, another one of, in the slogans, drive all blames into one. Has anybody ever heard that? It's one of the great, drive all blames into one. Now again, you talk about, bits and pieces, right? Paul, since you talked earlier, Paul, in your life, if you're honest, have you ever blamed anybody for anything? Have you ever blamed situations or, right, for things? Okay. Right, if I asked you, Paul, how many people, situations, things have you blamed in your life? Big or small?
Lots.
Lots. I'll accept that. And Paul's just speaking for the rest of us, right? So in our life, we hold everybody responsible for everything, right? We're always blaming. I don't know, Desiree is only 10. I don't know if you've gotten to the stage yet where you blame your parents for all your problems. Have you gotten there yet? Oh, you have. All right. Yeah, so all of a sudden, right? I mean, when you were 5 years old, you thought your parents were the most wonderful people in the world, right? And now you get 10 and you go, right? Can you see? And you start blaming them for everything. So the slogan says, drive all blames into one. Wow, right? What's that, What's this one thing? Rather than blaming everything and everybody, what's this one thing to be blamed? Blame means what? To hold responsible for. And in the teaching, that one thing is egocentricity. Self. Why do people act the way they do? Do the things they do or don't do? Because they're caught up in the belief in their separate self. And around their separate self is a whole narrative about self, which promotes selfishness and self-centeredness, ignorance, all kinds of afflictions. Drive all blames into one means when I am suffering. So when your parents say you can't do this or you can't do that, right? And you want to, and you're unhappy, right? You think they're the cause of your unhappiness, right? And if only they would do what you want, then what? Then you'd be happy. Right, exactly right. That's you know what? Even though you're 10, people who are 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 and 70 still think the same way. I still think that the source of their suffering, their unhappiness, is externals. But the truth is, and Desiree, if you can get this when you're 10, you'll be saving yourself a lot of trouble. Okay? Because Desiree, your unhappiness is arising where? Within your own mind, right? I mean, your dad might have said you can't do something or you got to do something that's right. But is he unhappy? No. Right? Unhappiness is in you. So drive all blames into one means you really see that the unhappiness I feel, not the situation, right? But just, can't do this, but that unhappiness, or that, angry or resentful, they won't let you do what you want, that's all arising within your own mind, isn't it? It's not out there, is it? So when you understand that, you understand, oh, no matter what the situation is, no matter what mom or dad or somebody at school, teacher has done or doesn't done, right? The person who is unhappy or who's angry or sad is you, isn't it? Yeah. And so when you understand that, you realize if you, you know, if you don't want to be an unhappy person, right? You don't like being unhappy, or you don't like being sad, or you don't like being angry. You realize, oh, I need to take care of that unhappiness within myself. Doesn't mean I still don't deal with my parents or my teachers, right, or kids at school, but I don't have that unhappiness or I don't have that anger because I understand it's inside me. Okay? So it's like that. Drive all blames into one. Because again, we spend so much time blaming other people and situations and our childhood and our parents for something that now exists within me, right, in my own mind. And if I'm going to be free of it, I can only be free of it, not by making them change, but by what? Understanding that my unhappiness is only in here, nowhere else. And I can transform that right now. Drive all blames into one, very powerful. Next time you're blaming your parents, teachers, friends, remember that. Yeah. Again, doesn't mean that you may not disagree with it, right? Doesn't mean you don't want to talk to them about it, right? But it means that that suffering inside you, that unhappiness or that anger, right? Because when you're angry, do you feel happy? No. When you're sad, do you feel happy? No. It's affecting you, isn't it? And if you really want to be happy, to have a happy mind, then you realize I don't want to keep doing this to myself. So good. Drive all blames into one. First begin with the preliminaries. These are some of the slogans. So it's a wonderful, for those who aren't familiar with these mind trainings, please access them. And these days there's a lot of commentary on them, these mind trainings. Good. So we've come to the end of our Dharma talk.